Welcome to another episode of Jamaican Gangster. On today's episode, we are featuring Early Bird, the secret king of Matthew's Lane, and the architect of the Spangler Posse's rise to international power. If you are not following us, we would be honored if you would consider doing so. It costs you nothing to hit that button, so that you will be notified every time we release a new episode. Now, let's get into it. He never made speeches. He never needed to. In a world where power announced itself with motorcades and gunfire and yard gatherings that drew hundreds of people, Early Bird moved differently. He was the quiet infrastructure of a machine that was already reshaping two cities at once. Kingston knew what he meant to Matthew's Lane, and New York was beginning to understand what his name meant in the trade corridors that connected the Caribbean to the American Northeast. And yet, most of the people who feared him could not have told you exactly what he looked like or where he spent his evenings. That was not an accident. That was the design. Matthew's Lane sat in the heart of downtown Kingston, a narrow, dense, deeply loyal People's National Party community packed between the commerce of the city and the silence of territories where strangers did not walk comfortably. By the time the 1980s arrived, and Jamaica's drug economy began to plug into American demand with a force that surprised even seasoned law enforcement, Matthew's Lane was already organized. It had its own chain of command, its own code of loyalty, and its own understanding of what protection meant. What it did not yet have was a pipeline that could compete with what the Shower Posse was building out of Tivoli Gardens under JLP alignment across town. Early Bird changed that. The precise origins of his leadership are told differently by different people, and that ambiguity was part of what kept him safe for as long as it did. What the record makes clear is that by the mid-1980s, the Spangler Posse had established itself as a serious operational force in New York City. They were not the only Jamaican crew working the Northeast Corridor, but they were among the most disciplined. Crack cocaine had detonated across American cities, and the demand was outrunning supply chains faster than most networks could adapt. The Spangler Posse adapted. The money that came back to Kingston fed Matthew's Lane. It paid for loyalty, it bought silence, and it funded the kind of community presence that made a Don untouchable by the people he lived among. Early Bird sat at the top of that structure on the New York side. He was the connective tissue between the Kingston Yard and the American Street, and he moved like a ghost.
That word, ghost, was not a romantic cessation. It was a professional description. Federal agents and DEA analysts who were building intelligence files on Jamaican Pazes in the late 1980s found that some leaders left footprints everywhere.
They talked. They flashed. They had enemies willing to testify. Others left almost nothing. Early Bird was in the second category. People in the trade knew the name. The organization around him knew the structure. But peeling it back required years of work, subpoenas, and the slow assembling of testimony from people who had every reason not to speak. Microhook one. The question that federal investigators kept coming back to was not what Early Bird was doing. It was how he had stayed invisible for so long while moving so much. The Spangler Posse's New York operations during this period were not small. The DEA's attention to Jamaican posse activity through the late 80s and into the early 90s produced a picture of networks with genuine organizational depth, communication systems, distribution chains, and violence capabilities that put them in a different category from street-level crews. The Spangler operation was part of that picture. And at the center of the Matthew's Lane side of that operation, the man who connected community loyalty in Kingston to cash flow in New York was Early Bird. Back in downtown Kingston, Matthew's Lane was watching. The community did not need press releases or street announcements to know what was being built in their name. The money flowing back was real. The protection was real. The silence that surrounded it was enforced not only by fear, but by a sense of belonging that garrison communities produce in ways that outsiders consistently underestimate. Matthew's Lane never forgot who built the foundation. That phrase would come to mean something very specific after 1990. But before we reach that morning, we have to understand the bond that made what happened after so consequential. His name was Zeke's. Some say his full name was different, but in Matthew's Lane, and in the crime reporting that would follow him across two decades. He was Zeke's, the man who would become the undisputed king of that territory. At this point in the story, Zeke's was not the king. He was the younger force watching the architecture that Early Bird had built. The relationship between them was described in later reporting and in community accounts with a consistency that suggests something closer than simple hierarchy. This was a brotherly bond, not necessarily biological, but the kind of loyalty that garrison culture builds between men who came up together, who understood each other's risks, and who trusted each other with the kind of information that could end a life. What Early Bird gave Zeke's was not just a position, it was a model. The discipline of silence, the patience of building before expanding, the understanding that power exercised invisibly lasts longer than power announced loudly. Micro Hook 2, the question planted early in this story, the one that would not be answered for years, was this: when Early Bird died, who exactly made the call, and why did the silence around it hold so completely? By 1989 and into 1990, the federal machinery was beginning to catch up. DEA and Department of Justice operations, targeting Jamaican pazas, were producing indictments. Court records from that period document prosecutions of Spangler-affiliated individuals in the American Northeast. The structure that had operated in relative shadow was being illuminated from the outside in. Names were appearing in affidavits. The walls of the ghost house were starting to have light behind them. This is where the consequence escalation ladder begins its climb. It started with individual exposure. One indicted associate, then another, then a third. Each arrest created pressure. Each pressure point created the possibility of someone talking in the world. Early Bird moved through. The possibility of someone talking was not an abstract threat. It was a countdown, and the clock was running in ways that not everyone in the organization could see clearly. Downtown Kingston felt the pressure differently than New York did. In Matthews Lane, the information that came back was filtered through loyalty and interpretation. Some reports say the tension of that period was palpable in the community. Others say that Early Bird himself seemed calm in the days before it happened, which is either the composure of a man who trusted his people, or the stillness of a man who already sensed something was wrong, but had no way to stop it. We cannot confirm what he knew or did not know in those final days. That belongs to the unverified. What we can confirm is the morning itself. All Souls Morning, November of 1990. The name carries its own weight in Jamaican religious and cultural life, a period tied to remembrance of the dead, to candles lit for those who have passed, to a particular quality of quiet that settles over certain communities in the early hours of that day. That was the morning Early Bird was killed. The details of who pulled the trigger and under whose instruction have never been fully resolved in public record. What the Jamaica Gleaner documented and what subsequent reporting confirmed was the death itself, the community reaction, and the acceleration of events that followed. The killing was brutal. It was not a warning shot or a message of ambiguity. It was a conclusion. Micro Hook 3. The silence that surrounded the question of who ordered it was not the silence of ignorance. Everybody in Matthews Lane had a theory. Nobody said it out loud. That silence was its own kind of weapon. It protected the living. It insulated the community from further exposure. And it left the wound open in a way that would shape everything that came next. When news of Early Bird's death spread through Matthews Lane that morning, what followed was grief and rage, in proportions that the community had not shown publicly in a very long time. He was not just a posse leader who had died. He was the man who had built the foundation. He was the architect of the pipeline. He was the one who had made Matthews Lane a name that meant something beyond its own narrow lanes. Matthews Lane never forgot. That phrase, already alive in the community's internal understanding, now became something else. It became a declaration. Zeke stepped into the space. He did not step quietly, not in the way Early Bird had operated. Zeke's was a different kind of force. What he inherited was the structure, the loyalty, the territory, and the anger. What he added was a visibility and an authority that turned Matthews Lane from a connected garrison into what authorities would later describe as a state within a state. The transformation that Early Bird had begun in discipline and silence, Zeke's would complete in dominance and presence. But before the living took over, the community did something for the dead that is rarely documented in the history of Kingston's gang geography. They painted him on the walls, the murals that appeared on the lanes and fence faces of Matthew's Lane after Early Bird's death were not quiet tributes. They were elaborate, vivid, cinematic portraits. His face went up in the colors of the community, in the imagery of memory and power and grief, combined into something that the walls of a garrison territory had rarely displayed so openly. People who walked through Matthew's Lane in the months and years after 1990 saw a man preserved, not in a church program or a police file, but in the paint of the streets he had controlled. Micro Hook 4, the murals did something specific. They made a ghost visible, and that visibility became a battleground. The Jamaica Constabulary Force did not see the murals as grief. The official position, reflected in policing action over the years that followed, was that they constituted glorification of criminality. Officers came with paint. The wall faces were covered. Matthew's Lane responded by putting Early Bird back up. The cycle repeated. Cover, restore, cover, restore. It was not simply a decoration dispute. It was a war over what the community was allowed to remember, what power it was allowed to claim, and whose version of the man on the wall would stand. The police who came with their rollers were not wrong that the murals sent a message. They were correct about that. But the message they were trying to erase was also the message that held the community together. Silence about who killed him, visibility about what he meant. Those two things ran in parallel, and neither one would fully give way. This is the midpoint pressure spike, because at this exact moment, two forces were pressing from opposite directions. Federally, the Spangler indictments were moving through American courts. Domestically, the mural war was revealing how deep the community investment in Early Bird's legacy had become, and Zeke's, now the inheriting king, was navigating both pressures simultaneously while building his own authority on top of a foundation that had been laid by a man who could no longer speak for himself. The mystery thread holds here. Who ordered the killing on All Souls' Morning? It was the question that the mural carried without answering. Every face painted on those walls was also a question. Matthew's Lane never forgot. But forgetting and forgiving were different things, and justice in that world did not travel through courts. As the 90s progressed, the federal architecture around the Spangler posse became more concrete. DEA and DOJ records from the early 1990s document prosecutions of Spangler-connected defendants operating in the Northeast United States. The network that Early Bird had helped build was being disassembled from the outside in. Associates were indicted. Money flows were disrupted. The discipline of silence that had protected the organization for years was being overcome by the accumulated weight of law enforcement pressure and the willingness of peripheral figures to cooperate with federal prosecutors. Each prosecution was a consequence climbing the ladder. Individual harm had already happened when Early Bird died. Community fear had been the mural war. System response was now the federal dragnet, and the internal dimension of it, the pressure on Zeke's to maintain cohesion inside Matthew's Lane, while the American side of the network contracted, was the internal collapse that the consequence ladder had been building toward. The Spangler posse did not disappear. Jamaican posse networks showed a resilience through the 1990s that frustrated federal prosecutors precisely because they were not centralized in ways that made decapitation effective. Remove one leader, another adapted. Cut one supply chain, another developed. But the specific architecture that Early Bird had built, the ghost infrastructure, the discipline of silence, the invisible management of the New York corridor, that particular model did not survive his death intact. Zeke's rebuilt differently, louder, more territorial, more visible in his authority over downtown Kingston, in ways that would eventually attract the kind of attention that leads to arrests, to riots, and to the kind of confrontation with the state that defines the later chapters of the Matthew's Lane story. But that is Zeke's story, already told in its own episode. This story belongs to the man who made Zeke's possible. The mural war eventually quieted, not because either side fully won it, but because time does what force cannot always accomplish. The walls changed, the lanes changed. The faces of Matthew's Lane changed in ways that all garrison communities change when enough years accumulate and enough bodies mark the ground. But people who grew up in Matthew's Lane, who passed those walls as children in the early 1990s, still describe the murals with a precision that suggests they are not forgotten images. They are fixed. They are the way that community chose to answer the silence about who killed him. Matthew's Lane never forgot. And the man who killed Early Bird, whoever that was, made one decision that his successors would spend years living inside. He created a legend. He turned a ghost into a permanent presence. Every wall they painted over, the community repainted, every indictment that came down from New York, the loyalty in Kingston held, and the operation that Early Bird had built with silence and patience outlasted him in ways that the people who wanted him gone had not anticipated. The federal record confirmed the reach, the mural confirmed the meaning, and the silence that held around the question of his killing confirmed that in Matthew's Lane, the deepest power was not what you announced, it was what you refused to say. He operated in the dark, he built in the quiet, he died on a morning named for the dead. And then he became exactly what that morning is named for. He became a soul that the living could not put down. That was the story of Early Bird. If this episode moved you, if it taught you something, if it kept you up, share it. Follow us if you have not already, and stay close, because on the next episode of Jamaican Gangster, we are going somewhere you are not ready for.